This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of February 2nd, 2020. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 119. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this edition, the Is It Just Me commentary. Headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. The Big Deal feature. I begin coverage of the 10th anniversary of the Vancouver 2010 Winter Olympic Games. The first part of a two-part interview with George Orr, the veteran broadcaster. George produced and directed the documentary Chasing the Dream, the real story of Vancouver's Olympics. And I will award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. Now, is it just me? Is it just me, or should British Columbia's government be doing more to combat misinformation and give people peace of mind about coronavirus? The World Health Organization has declared a global health emergency, but this has also reignited paranoia and fear in China and Hong Kong, where many people remember the SARS epidemic of 2003. British Columbia has one case so far. Meanwhile, across Canada this flu season, six people have died of the flu. Paranoia and fear were stoked in BC when a Chinese language news website called Lahu.ca interviewed Burnaby City Councillor James Wang. Wang claimed that a visitor from China got sick in BC and went to hospitals in Vancouver and Burnaby and a clinic in Lougheed, but went home to Shanghai and was finally diagnosed there with coronavirus. Wang even gave an alleged itinerary for the visitor, including dates of visits to area shopping malls and restaurants. The problem is, the news website did not actually interview the person who claimed to have been misdiagnosed in BC. There has been no independent verification of Wang's story, and Provincial Health Officer Dr. Bonnie Henry has warned against third and fourth-hand information. But the damage was already done, as masks flew off store shelves and people stayed away from restaurants and stores for fear of catching coronavirus. So the BC government has not done enough to combat misinformation in English or Chinese. When I checked on January 31st, the government's homepage, YouTube page, and Facebook account had no information about coronavirus facts and myths. But on Facebook, there was a nice photo of a piece of cake topped by yummy Fraser Valley berries. What good will that do? What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. Tashni Sukumaran of the South China Morning Post reports, if the China coronavirus doesn't get you in Malaysia, fake racist news about it might. Misinformation about the virus has become so pervasive that Malaysia's health minister warns it's a more critical issue than the disease itself. But who should take charge of combating rumors that are so far off the mark they could be fatal? Governments or the social media giants? In the last week, Malaysian police have arrested six people for spreading fake news on the Wuhan virus, while the Singapore government invoked its controversial Protection from Online Falsehoods and Manipulation Act for the fourth time to correct online falsehoods related to the virus. Its correction orders can now be used on search engines and social media platforms such as Facebook, Baidu, and Twitter for notices visible to all users rather than just those who access the fake news item. Bloomberg reports that for $193, a flight between Hong Kong and New York with a six-hour stopover in virus-hit Wuhan. Bargain flights between Hong Kong and New York have emerged in the wake of the new coronavirus, as long as travelers are willing to stop in Wuhan, the epicenter of the outbreak, in just a few months. Flying with China Southern Airlines to John F. Kennedy International Airport on May 20th costs only $193, according to travel booking site Kayak.com. The trip includes 6 hours and 35 minutes in Wuhan. The next cheapest ticket with China Eastern Airlines via Shanghai is $487. A direct American Airlines flight is only $2,688, if you want to pay that much. Wuhan and the surrounding region are currently in lockdown, effectively quarantining some 50 million people. A raft of international airlines from British Airways to Singapore Airlines to Air Canada are chopping flights to mainland China. Jack Snape reports in ABC News Australia. Government's sports grants leaked spreadsheet reveals more secrets about the scheme. When a leaked spreadsheet emerged this week, Outrage around the government's sports grant scheme reached a climax. Clubs have demanded the government respond, and some have called for the minister in charge of the scheme, Bridget McKenzie, to resign or to be stood down. But whether the minister goes or not, there's plenty more hidden in the spreadsheet about the scheme dubbed dodgy by the opposition. Cricket, with almost 500,000 participants, led with $37 million in funding, or $76 per person. Aussie Rules football got $50 per person, touch football $47 per person. Meanwhile, at the other end of the scale, fitness and gym and walking got $3 and $2 respectively per person. Law firms hope to sign up clubs for class actions that would appeal the funding decisions in the courts and potentially challenge the government's constitutional power to allocate grants to benefit political interests. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. Douglas Perry reports in the Oregonian, Super Bowl Sunday is a big day for a Portland professor because he's a palindrome expert. Aziz Inan can't wait for Sunday to arrive, but not because he's a 49ers or Chiefs fan. Super Bowl Sunday this year is what the University of Portland electrical engineering professor calls a ubiquitous palindrome date. That is, the full eight-figure numerical date, 0202-2020, reads the same backward as forward all over the world. The last time it happened, Inan points out, was way back in the 12th century on 11-11-11-11. The next time it will happen, after Super Bowl Sunday, that is, will be 101 years from now on 12-12-21-21. The time after that won't be until 0303-3030. On Czech news, the first month of 2020 will officially go down as one of the wettest Januaries on record for some parts of Vancouver Island. Fifth wettest in nearly 100 years of records is actually quite remarkable, said Environment Canada meteorologist Armel Castellan. 600 millimeters of precipitation has been recorded in the Comox Lake watershed in January, the second most in 39 years of record keeping. January also saw a mid-month cold snap and snowstorm that blanketed the entire island, making it one January most people will not forget. And parenthetically, if you hear the noise in the background, that is not a sound effect, that is a real monsoon in Vancouver as I record the Breaker.News podcast. In the Seattle Times, Associated Press reports, Kent closes 18 illegal massage stores, cites possible ties to human trafficking. City authorities say the illicit businesses operated late at night and were often fronts for organized crime, according to King TV. The new ordinance allows police to determine whether or not businesses are in compliance with state sanitation and hygiene requirements, city officials said. The department is willing to share what they've learned with other departments, said Kent Police Chief Rafael Padilla. And only in the Breaker.News this week, these headlines. Chinese citizen from Surrey jailed in Spain to plead guilty in U.S. college admissions scandal. BC's money laundering public inquiry will be lawyer-palooza. And the Breaker Vision. Politicians say the darndest things at Richmond Lunar New Year event. Read the Breaker.News for these stories and more.
The torch is a lot more than fire on a stick.
I mean, anything I've ever done in my past compared to this is as complicated as managing my sock drawer.
I was starting to think about, you know, what could I do that could somehow repay the province and the country for what they've done for me.
Those were some of the sounds of the Vancouver 2010 Winter Olympics torch relay coming over the Lionsgate Bridge on February 12, 2010, the opening day of the Games. And those were the voices of Premier Gordon Campbell, Vancouver Olympics CEO John Furlong, and Chair Jack Poole. That is from Chasing the Dream, the real story behind Vancouver's 2010 Olympic Games, a documentary about the 2010 Winter Olympics by veteran broadcaster George Orr. With the 10th anniversary of the biggest and most expensive peacetime event in Canadian history this month, I welcome back George Orr to the Breaker.News podcast. I sat down with George at a coffee shop on Lonsdale in North Vancouver on a rainy Friday afternoon to remember that magical month of February 2010. Back in 2010, there was rain and very little snow, There was a lot of sunshine and unusually mild spring-like temperatures. There were also questions about the costs, the benefits, and the legacy of the games.
The genesis of the idea came from amateur sport. A couple of amateur sport boosters, Sport DC, people thought, well, we need some better amateur sport facilities. We need to rebuild Empire Stadium. Hey, why don't we talk about Olympics to make that happen? And they got the snowball rolling, but it was really the people that are in your film who took the torch and who did the heavy lifting, got the money out of government, the billions of dollars out of government, and were the ones that were putting their reputations on the line.
Jack Poole, a businessman, very successful in real estate and development, not a public person at all, helped construct an environment around the games in which everything they did was kept pretty well secret. What they wanted people to see was the games at the end, not the process throughout. So I was not welcome with my camera. Took me 6 years to convince Poole to talk to me. Eventually he did sit down. We talked about everything, including his cancer. Gordon Campbell, the premier, is somewhere in the process, he got arrested for drinking in Hawaii. He wasn't very happy to talk about this. And John Furlong, lovely fellow, but very shy and very quiet. So the three main characters in the bringing of the Olympics never really wanted to talk about their role in it particularly. So it was kind of a struggle to force them to do it.
Paul Manning is an interesting figure who had been an aide of Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau back in the 1970s, had been very close to power and had come to be close to Jack Poole in his business, a real estate developer who was also involved in other events in Vancouver like the Molson Indy. They set out to find the right people to run the show and also the strategies that they thought would succeed. I mean, the Four Host First Nations was very important because the history in British Columbia, we're seeing it again, how there's discord between various First Nations groups and the government. There were fears right up until and even during the Olympics that there would be blockades and protests. They had to get the leadership on board.
Part of what made all that happen was part of Poole's heritage is First Nations. And so he grew up with, you know, a better than average understanding of the oppression First Nations have gone through. And he realized that politically it had to change, and here was an opportunity to force a change socially on BC by doing this. And so they approached the First Nations, the four First Host First Nations, and they got buy-in. And they were told by the IOC that buy-in was the penny that dropped that got the games to Vancouver.
You document in the film, it's about 75 minutes long or so, with all that material that you shot, with all that went on, you followed an interesting storyline there to show how the bid happened and how Vanhock itself evolved, the pitfalls up and down along the way, and the challenges they faced and some of the mistakes they made and some of the embarrassing mistakes they made. We saw what happened at one news conference where one of the featured athletes collapsed and the show went on instead of stopping and pausing and saying, let's regroup in a few minutes after she's okay. They just kept on going. That was after having myself covered so many Vanhock news conferences.
You did?
That, in a nutshell, was a microcosm of what went on. There was a lot of that going on that they didn't stop and be human in many times.
No. I believe that they were under orders from the IOC head office in Europe. Run it like a ship. It moves on time. You write the press release in advance. That's the story that gets told. You feed the daily press the daily story. It's like a cookie. You give everybody a cookie. They go away happy. In a competitive environment, nobody gets beat on Olympic stories. The Olympic broadcaster is terrified of doing something that will put them offside, so that particular newsroom is essentially neutered. The others are all terrified to do much about the Olympics because the copyright lawyers with the Olympic, I mean, there's a bus full of copyright lawyers, so they watch everything with a stopwatch, and they managed it extremely thoroughly. They had everybody cowed except, well, you. And me to some degree, but you definitely, you were the person who would show up at these events, ask questions. The people at the table would all look grumpy and say, we'll talk to you later, and then they wouldn't talk to you. You held them to grand accounting. It was good to watch, but it didn't really change what they did.
It was fun while it lasted, and they had to be held to account. They were spending billions of dollars on their own, and they were the trigger to the spending of billions of dollars by other bodies. That was money that was the product of the hard work of British Columbians, and there was a lot of controversy of whether this was the right expenditure, right investment in a province like this with so many problems then that still has the same social and economic problems and the inequality.
I have a friend who just retired from the OPP in Ontario at a very senior level, and in the run-up to the games, his people were told, make up a shopping list of all the toys and tools you think you might ever need, and the Olympics is your excuse to get them. And he did, and they did. They didn't even, a lot of it came here, but some of it went to other parts of the country too, because this was the great cash cow for entities like police to, we have to have security. So I think, I understand they spent somewhere north of $1 billion on security. There were no problems, but a lot of technology went around Canada that didn't directly benefit anybody.
We don't know if even the surveillance camera system that they ordered ever worked. I got whistleblowers come and tell me that it wasn't working in the weeks before the games, and they never really did show it off for us. They never did a media tour to show off the security operation like other Olympic cities have done. That was one of the aspects, and of course the security operation. There were still protests. They managed to snuff some out, but there were other things that happened. The $2 million of hockey tickets, the credit card scam that happened with the Latvian crime syndicate, that was something that could have been prevented, but it happened, and there really wasn't much justice there, but a lot of angry people with credit cards that had to be reactivated and couldn't be used after spending money on the Vanhock ticket website.
And, you know, the sad part of it is the three men at the heart of this, the premier stepped in a cow pie around the HST and quit. Jack Poole died before the games, and John Furlong walked away from public life because the challenges were more than he could deal with. So the legacy that these three people created, I don't think is as big as they wanted it to be for BC, and certainly not as big as it should have been for them, which is kind of sad. They... like it or not, like them or not, they put their hearts into doing something they thought would be a benefit to BC. And part of what the movie illustrates is what they were doing, why they were doing it. This is not an attack film. I'm not trying to pick them apart. I just watched them do what they did, listened to them say what they said, sat them down, talked to them, and told the story. And it's a piece of history.
Yeah, with Gordon Campbell and HST, that was an interesting time that happened. That was July 2009. That was in the middle of the countdown, shortly after the election, where they basically undersold the deficit, and they came out of the election, and suddenly the deficit was multitudes bigger. And as I found out through my own research afterwards, that they were very worried behind the scenes at the time, with all the sponsors sitting on their wallets or even going bankrupt. The sponsors weren't able to fulfill their obligations, and they were worried about BC having to be subject to lawsuits or write big checks to the IOC afterwards, because BC was the guarantor. It was on BC's shoulders. So the HST, I often call it the host city tax, or the Olympic host tax, because that was one of the reasons why they brought it about. They needed help to arrange the worst case scenario should that happen after February 2010.
Well, they it's interesting how quickly it all went away. They had grand dreams that somehow this would transform us into a more social community, into a more collaborative people, into something that they weren't really able to define what that would be. And ultimately, the games weren't able to provide that as a product, because they weren't a grand experiment in social engineering. They were a series of spectacles that were very expensive to go to. So if you went to a hockey game, you spent a lot of money to stand in line for 3 hours in the rain to get into a hockey game, and you saw a hockey game. So what they'd hoped to do, I think, with the games, in the moment it seemed to work, but in retrospect, I don't think so.
It certainly was a grand spectacle on TV, which is where most British Columbians did experience it. As a documentary filmmaker, it threw some challenges to you because of, as you said, the boatload of IOC lawyers and how they protect their property, their rights. We don't see any highlights in the film. Of course, that's not the kind of film you're trying to make, but I'm sure you would have enjoyed dropping one or two in. Tell me about that challenge.
They would not give me accreditation for anything because they couldn't manage me. I wasn't working. They couldn't see the product I was making. So at times they were dishonest about their intent around me. At times they just wouldn't answer the phone, and at times they just blew me off. And I've been in journalism long enough to hear the word no as an opportunity, not as a dismissal. So I would show up, smile, set up my little camera, roll, get shuffled around. The allies for me in this were the news camera people in Vancouver, because I was one of them for 10 years. So they would go to an event, they'd all plug in, I'd plug in the audio system, and I'd work with them. I knew them all from previous lives. So they would, it's not like I snuck in with them, but I would arrive with them and be part of that crew enough that the IOC folks couldn't get rid of me. But and in the end, John Furlong sat down and talked to me at length, and we actually ended up having three lengthy one-on-one interviews. And I grew to admire the guy for his ingenuous notion that he could actually make the world a better place through athletics. And I'm sorry he's fallen off the public map, but if I had put as much work into the average story as I did into getting these guys to play, I would have been an award-winning journalist.
You know, you mentioned, of course, Gordon Campbell, his fall from grace, which he survived in 2001, the Maui drinking driving incident, didn't survive the HST. And then, of course, with Jack Poole, you drew the line there. I mean, Gordon Campbell had actually worked for Jack Poole way back when in construction. And Jack Poole himself, the way the story is told, and you've got the clip of him at the Plaza of Nations after winning the bid, after coming back from Prague, and saying those prophetic words that the next thing we'll have to worry about really is the torch relay. And of course, the torch was lit in Olympia, Greece. I was there for it, and approached both Gordon Campbell and John Furlong afterwards, and they were visibly shaken. They should have been in a joyful mood, but they had just gotten off the phone from back in Vancouver, and the next day Jack Poole had succumbed to pancreatic cancer. After surviving it the first round, you couldn't make it through the second round. That really was quite a tragedy that did, however, inspire Vanock to make it to the finish line.
I think so. Jack made it known right away he wasn't going to talk to anybody, you, me, anybody. And I just pressed gently through a variety of sources and contacts, and ultimately, his wife, Darlene, had worked at CKNW back when I was a younger reporter at CKNW. And we knew each other, and she, I guess over supper one night, said, "Why don't you just talk to him? I know who he is. He won't bite you." And so we sat down in his office, and the deal was everything's on the table. There are no questions to not ask. So we talked about the games and his growing up and his money and what he was trying to do. And as I'm starting to pack up, I'm thinking, I got to ask. So I said, "So, cancer." 15 minutes, he told me the tragic story of dying of pancreatic cancer, because at that point he was only months away from dying. And completely open, candid, I think he realized that an interview like this could be part of his legacy. So, and quite a lovely guy. I think that I think he had good intentions. I think what they wanted to do was grand. Like I said, I don't think it worked. It did in the moment, but in the long run, no. But I'm really glad I pushed hard enough to get Poole, because I think in many ways, the Jack Poole Plaza, these were Jack Poole's games.
Jack's team had done their job, and now, for them, it was over. They had done what Jack had asked them to do.
The kind of life that I've had has been one, you know, loaded with good luck. Coming here, having the opportunity to become involved with an event that, you know, that is just mind-blowing. But to have the opportunity it's like a dream, you know, to have it.
Jack Poole had wanted to change not just the face of British Columbia, but the character of the nation. A man of business and a grateful Canadian, he wanted to kindle something deep in the spirit of the people here, to encourage others to discover here what he had found. That was Jack Poole's dream.
We'll look back, you know, over the years, and we'll say, you know, that's what 2010 did for us. That's what it did.
That was a clip from Chasing the Dream, the real story behind Vancouver's 2010 Olympic Games, by George Orr, who was my guest. You can see the documentary on February 13th at 7:15 p.m. at Delbrook Community Recreation Center in North Vancouver. Part 2 of my interview with George Orr is on next week's edition. The virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting. Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to a person or group that is making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to anyone who is in the battle to beat cancer, from the scientists seeking a cure to the doctors caring for ill patients and for those living with cancer and their loved ones. February 4th is World Cancer Day. Keep them in your minds. Survival rates have improved through the years, but there is still a long way to go. But, as Terry Fox said, someday the hurting must stop. Nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of February 2nd, 2020. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on February 2nd in 1922, it was 2-22-22 on 2-2-22? And on February 2nd in 1972, protesters burned the British Embassy in Dublin to protest the shooting of 13 people dead on Bloody Sunday. And on February 2nd in 1990, South Africa's President F.W. de Klerk promised to free Nelson Mandela and legalize the African National Congress. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.